You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Blue Jays reporter Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, we continue to get through this roster as we get closer and closer to spring training, and we are really getting close now. It's outfield day here on the podcast, and when you look at this Blue Jays team, one piece of the outfield we weren't sure would be there, but is of course Jose Bautista in right field. We've talked about the fact that he is back into the fold, obviously with the new contract, back with the Blue Jays for probably a lot less money than the Blue Jays thought it would take. Now, Bautista is coming off a down year. There's no question about that. So how important to this Blue Jays team in 2017 is it that we see the vintage Jose Bautista?
Oh, I think it's really important. And when you're talking about trying to replace someone like Edwin Encarnacion and everything he brought to the lineup, I think the Blue Jays are kind of looking internally for some of those replacements, and an upseason from Jose Bautista would certainly help replace some of that lost production. He's someone who obviously dealt with a number of injuries in 2016, but when he was healthy, he still did okay. I mean, it wasn't quite as bad as the season that some people made it out to be. The power numbers were still there. The on-base percentage was still there. The batting average was clearly down, and there's obviously a potential for more, but I think the Blue Jays are optimistic that a healthy season from him will lead to that offensive uptick. And really, his type of bat is exactly what the Blue Jays needed. You look at that infield, and they've got a lot of plus offensive bats there. But in the outfield, until Bautista re-signed, there were a lot of question marks. And Bautista doesn't solve all of that, but he solves most of those problems. And if he can put anything up close to his career norms next year, it's going to be obviously a major addition for that lineup to keep him in there, and something that the Blue Jays desperately needed.
Then when you look over at left field, obviously Michael Saunders did such a great job really for the first half of the year, and then his numbers fell off a little bit in the second half. He is gone, but they acquired Melvin Upton Jr. at the trade deadline in 2016, and now he slides in there. I know you're going to get, to some degree, an inconsistent bat with Melvin Upton Jr. He's going to show some power at times. How about the defense? Here's a guy who played center field for a lot of years. Is he still a real good defender moving over to left?
He's still a pretty good defender, I would say. There does seem to be occasional times where, I don't want to say it's a lack of focus, because I don't think it's that, but he can get lost out there at times. But when he's on, I mean, the range is still there. There's no question about that. He still has a very strong arm, particularly for left field. Those are some of the assets he's going to bring. I think a lot of his at-bats will probably come against left-handed hitters. That was initially the plan when he was acquired last year. And I think he initially struggled going from a more full-time role in San Diego to a bit more platoon role in Toronto. But if you look historically at his numbers, he is a big offensive weapon against left-handed hitters. And so he's just going to have to get back into that platoon part-time type role that he had for a long time in Atlanta and San Diego prior to last year. So it's not something that he's totally unfamiliar with, but that's really where his value lies.
All right, and then the other half of that platoon in left, you would think at this point heading into spring training, Ezekiel Carrera shapes up to be that guy. He had some great moments in 2016. What do you expect from this guy in 2017, maybe getting a little more time earlier in the year?
Yeah, and he's someone who's historically spent a lot of his time as a part-time player, but he really thrived in that role last year. He took over the starting job from Michael Saunders down the stretch when Saunders was struggling. It was Carrera who stepped up at the beginning of September and really kind of took the reins of that job. And he brings a lot of things that John Gibbons likes, and something that the Blue Jays don't have a lot of, which is speed and the ability to create things on the base pass, play a little bit of small ball with the bunt. That's something the Blue Jays don't have a lot of. And so right now, I think, he's looking to get a lot of the at-bats against right-handed pitching to form that platoon with Upton. I think the one thing that'll be a difference in 2017 is Carrera shouldn't be expected to hit near the top of the lineup like he did during that stretch run a year ago. Ideally that leadoff spot will go to Devin Travis, and then when Carrera's in the lineup, he can hit either out of the 8 or number 9 hole, and that's more suited to his offensive abilities. But he gives this Blue Jays team a little bit of a different look, and something that they need to be able to create runs more than just via the home run.
Then over in center field, obviously Kevin Pillar is back for another year, and we know what you're going to get with him. It's that gold glove out there in center field. The bat is what it is, but just how about the health, Gregor, and the fact that this guy plays so hard out there in center field that sometimes you kind of have your fingers crossed when you watch him going after a ball.
No, you really do. And one thing I think fans don't always get a true view of is the fact that Pillar, he's in the lineup almost every single day, but he's a guy who has been banged up over the course of his career as well. He deserves a lot of credit for being able to remain in the lineup. He's very hard-nosed that way, but certainly there are risks he takes in the outfield. But that's where his asset is. I mean, his most value is going to be from the defensive side of things. He's still, is a guy who's a free swinger at the plate. You're not going to get a very high on-base percentage with him. He is going to be able to create some things every now and then by hitting the gaps, but he's a guy who's not going to get on base that much, and that's where his defense really comes into play. And that's why when you look at this Blue Jays team, you want to see a lot of your offensive production in the outfield coming from left field and right field. You don't want to necessarily worry too much about it in center field, and Pillar is going to help out the pitching staff more than anything else by keeping runs off the board as opposed to putting a lot of them up.
Now the wild card here is, and a guy that the Blue Jays have been hoping, I think, would come into his own the last couple of years. 2015, we saw him fly through the minor leagues, and it looked like he was going to kind of burst onto the scene. But then Dalton Pompey hasn't quite lived up to the hype at that point when he kind of came out of nowhere. Where does he stand as far as this roster goes? Does he have a shot? Can he play his way into a regular role in that outfield?
I think he can, and he's going to be one of the main guys to watch in spring training. I mean, for the most part, this roster is relatively set, but left field is one area and the back end of the bullpen where jobs are up for grabs. And while it looks right now that Upton and Carrera will form a platoon in left field, I don't think either guy is really striking a lot of fear into the hearts of the opposition. That job really is up for grabs. And Pompey, there's no question about it. He was rushed to the big leagues, probably to his detriment. He was handed the starting job in center field a couple years ago, prematurely after just going through all three levels of the minor leagues the year before. And I think that hampered his development a little bit. But I think being able to spend the entire season at AAA in 2016 is going to serve him well. And people forget he's still only 24 years old. And so when you look at the options that the Blue Jays have in left field, and then you look at the upside of a 24-year-old guy like Dalton Pompey, gives the Blue Jays a little bit more options out there. And I think this is kind of, it's not a make or break year for his career. As a 24-year-old, you can never say that. But in terms of really seizing this opportunity and cementing his spot as a full-time player, this is kind of the best opportunity he's going to have. And that job is up for grabs, and he gives the Blue Jays a bit of a different look as well. I mean, when you talk about Ezekiel Carrera and some of the things that he brings, Dalton Pompey could be that player, but he's someone who comes with more upside. And so he's going to need a very strong spring training to really capitalize. But if he comes out and has a really strong few weeks at camp, he's someone that the Blue Jays, I think, really could be looking at. And that would require a move with either Upton or Carrera. But those are two flexible pieces where you could get a little bit creative and find some time for Pompey.
And you said it, in a spring training where there's not going to be a lot of drama as far as who fits in where, left field is certainly one spot where I'm sure you'll be spending a lot of time focusing on, Gregor, and writing a lot about as we get into mid-February and March. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Blue Jays edition. For Gregor Chisholm, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Orioles reporter Brittany Giroli. We continue to make our way through the Orioles roster as we get ready for spring training 2017 down in Sarasota. Today we cover the catchers and the possibilities for DH, Brittany. We'll start behind the plate, and obviously there's a new face back there. Matt Wieters still available on the free agent market, but not coming back to Baltimore. Wellington Castillo is the new addition. It's a one-year deal with an option for a second year. He's been on four teams now in three seasons. He put up good numbers a year ago with Arizona. What do the Orioles expect to get from Wellington Castillo?
Well, they expect to get, first and foremost, a good defensive catcher, and that's really what they wanted to make sure, that they were able to kind of fill the shoes left by Matt Wieters and kind of prioritize that. But also, it's becoming more and more rare, I think, to find a catcher who can hold his own offensively and do well behind the plate. And that's what they feel like they have in Wellington Castillo. They feel like he's a veteran guy. He'll be able to handle a pitching staff that's kind of coming into its own, or so they hope, this year. And he'll really be able to hold that down and not force one of their top prospects, Chance Sisko, not force him up from AAA before he's ready. So I think the move was a good one. I think it does a couple different things for them. And it is interesting because Matt Wieters is still out there, and we've seen stranger things happen. He doesn't really fit in with the way the Orioles have constructed their team at all. But, like I said, you just never know with the Orioles.
Yeah, and they've already benefited from waiting out things with Mark Trumbo, who we'll get to in a little bit. Who knows with Matt Wieters? But, yeah, it doesn't seem to be a fit at this point. So Castillo will be the guy the majority of the time. When you look at the backup situation, is Caleb Joseph kind of set there? I mean, is this a clear-cut 1-2 spot heading into spring training, or is there any competition?
No, not necessarily, because Caleb Joseph has an option remaining. And while he's considered a better defensive catcher than Francisco Pena, who's one of the other guys in camp, who was up with the club for certain points last year, Pena doesn't have an option. So what the Orioles might do, and what you see a lot of teams do, especially at the end of camp, is try and keep as many guys as they can. So if it's closed, they might end up optioning Caleb Joseph to AAA. I mean, that's a potential scenario, so they can keep as many guys as possible in their organization. So, again, if it's close, if Caleb Joseph outperforms Pena by a mile, I think it will be tougher to justify. But I don't think that backup catching role is quite as solidified as it may look on paper.
And then a waiver move, I guess, would be a necessary thing to send Pena through waivers to try to keep him around. What does he bring? You mentioned that he was up a little bit a year ago. Joseph better defensively. Is Pena better offensively?
Yes. Obviously, everyone knows Caleb Joseph, not a great offensive year last year. Zero RBI, zero home runs, really struggled at the plate. But Francisco Pena offers more in terms of that. But when you're looking at a backup catcher, I think for the most part, you prioritize defense and you just take whatever offense you're going to get. You want a guy who's not going to be a liability. You want a guy that pitchers like to throw to. And I think when you look at Pena versus Joseph, Joseph is probably a better fit because he's better defensively.
And then the other name you mentioned is Chance Sisko. And, of course, that's what the Orioles hope is the future as far as behind the plate. Not quite ready for the major leagues yet, but he's really stood out in the minor leagues. And in an organization that's a little bit short on prospects, Sisko really stands out as one of the premier guys down there in the Orioles system. So when you look at him, obviously in a perfect world, he won't be a part of this major league team in 2017. But what strides, I guess, do they hope he'll take this year?
Well, they hope that he'll get a little bit better behind the plate, get better at calling the game, blocking balls. He's made some strides. I just think it comes down to experience. And he was a very young player in AA last year, Tim. Really, offensively, is probably ahead of his defense right now. But his defense isn't a liability by any means. They feel like he just needs some more reps. He's still a young kid. And this move, as I said, will force him to kind of continue to progress at his own speed. And I think when you're looking at a kid like Chance Sisko, the future is very bright, and it's just a matter of getting more reps under his belt. And he'll be in Major League camp. They'll get to see him again, work with him again. But like you said, hopefully they won't need Chances go behind the plate in 2017. Hopefully they're okay with what they have, and they can allow him to be down there and really kind of develop and maybe be, a late call-up in September to kind of get his feet wet a little bit. I think that would probably be ideal for the Orioles.
Considering how thin they are at the minor league level as far as prospects go, is Chance Sisko untouchable? I mean, if the Orioles are in the race come July and they need to add a piece and they ask what teams want, is Chance Sisko a guy they would even consider moving, or is he an untouchable piece?
I think he's pretty close to untouchable because they don't have, as you mentioned, they don't have a whole lot of prospects. So dealing from that pool is really dangerous because you look at, okay, if Chance Sisko isn't going to be in the organization, who's going to catch in the next few years? Who's going to be our next catcher? You know, Castillo signed to that two-year deal, and then what do you do after that? So I think having a young catching prospect that you feel good about, and it's not just the Orioles. He's been listed on, top 100 lists. So he's a guy who, if they trade away, they're going to really be looking for that exact guy in two or three years. So I think that they would probably like to avoid dealing him away. They'd like to avoid dealing anyone away, Tim. I think they're in a situation where they should try to maybe just look for just paying for guys. You know, really need to build back up that minor league system. Although, on the flip side of that, of course, there's a window. And there's a lot of guys who are going to be free agents for the Orioles at the end of next season. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on Dan Duquette to kind of pick a side, I think, if they're in this thing around the trade deadline.
All right, and then finally, designated hitter-wise, Mark Trumbo is obviously the guy that will be in there the majority of the time. Is that the plan to just keep him out of the field, if at all possible? I mean, obviously injuries can occur, and maybe you need him to get a start here and there in the outfield or even at first base filling in. But is he going to be a DH for maybe more than 100 games this year?
Yeah, I think that's what they would like to do. You know, and it's interesting because Adam Jones kind of mentioned that, you know, they've made some nice moves over the weekend at Saturday's Fan Fest, but defensively they're still not very good, and especially in the outfield. So having Mark Trumbo play the outfield obviously would weaken things. They did get Seth Smith to try to help with that a little bit. They feel like Joey Rickard, who was out for a good chunk of last year, should help. And who knows what you're going to get out of Hyun-Soo Kim, who really surprised everybody with the way he played last year. So I think in a perfect scenario, in a dream scenario, Mark Trumbo is that middle of the order bat who DHs for the most part, maybe plays the outfield for a limited portion of games, but is a guy who's replaced for the late game defensive replacement. I think if you're the Orioles, you feel like last year you kind of got away with playing him in the outfield a lot. I know manager Buck Showalter feels like there's certainly a time and a place for Mark Trumbo. It's not for lack of effort. Trumbo's a very smart guy, a guy who tries very hard. But, you know, in the end, I think, Tim, getting a guy like Michael Bourne, maybe a defensive first outfielder, would still really help them. I don't know if it's in the cards for them, but they keep mentioning outfield depth. So I think you would like to see them add somebody who is a defense-first player, because they really don't have that guy on their roster. And it really ends up hurting a guy like Adam Jones, who is kind of forced to play out of position a lot. It really kind of hurts a pitching staff that isn't a big strikeout staff, so they really need to rely on that defense. So to kind of answer your question in a very long-winded way, I think, yes, they would prefer to have Mark Trumbo be pretty close to that everyday DH.
When he's not in there, is there a chance to give, who would be the guy that they would want to give a day off from in the field to stick in that DH spot in other times? Is it Chris Davis? Is it somebody else?
Davis is a good guy, yeah. I think they'd like to kind of rotate that around as best as they can. I mean, obviously, some of these younger guys, Manny Machado, Jonathan Scope, you're not going to really worry about having their legs be too tired, but Chris Davis is a good one. Adam Jones, even though he's a terrible DH and really kind of bugs everyone on the bench because he likes to be out there and playing. I think if you can get Joey Rickard once in a while to play center field, I think resting some of these regulars in the beginning of the year will really pay dividends toward the end of the season.
Great stuff. It's nice to have a DH there you can depend on, and obviously Wellington Castillo, a lot will be thrown on him this year in 2017, stepping into those shoes of Matt Wieters, who was an Oriole for so long. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Orioles edition. For Brittany Giroli, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with Brian Hoke, our MLB.com Yankees reporter. We continue to make our way around the Yankees roster as we head into the 2017 season, and more importantly, spring training, which is right around the corner. And today, Brian, we cover the starting rotation, which is going to be a very important part of this team, obviously. And there are some question marks there where if the right answers come through, this team could be very good. If it goes the other way, well, it could go the other way. But let's start at the top. You got to start a rotation talk with the ace, and that will again be Masahiro Tanaka, who put together his fullest season as a Yankee in 2016, 14-4, solid ERA. More importantly, he was a third of an inning shy of throwing 200 innings, and he made 31 starts, which is the most of his career as a Yankee. Everybody always talks about the arm and when's that injury going to become serious, but he showed no signs of it a year ago.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody's still talking about that. I think to his relief, the questions have been answered, at least for the time being. So, that is a storyline that followed him throughout his Yankee career. Obviously, he got off to that great start, his first 14 or so starts in 2014, but he's a different pitcher now. He has learned how to work with that injury, and you know, he's got a partially torn UCL. That hasn't changed. You can rehab it, but it never completely recovers. But I think anybody who watched him pitch last year would say he figured it out. He pitched like an ace. The Yankees have paid him like an ace. And you know what? Going into this year, it's going to be a storyline again, his health, but for a different reason. He can opt out of his contract after 2017 and could be a free agent. So, obviously, Tanaka looking for a big year like he had last year. And if he can repeat that, it'll help the Yankees. But in the long run, it might help Tanaka's wallet because he may wind up getting another contract out of it.
When you look after Tanaka, who's the clear number one, we can go through all these other pitchers. I'm not exactly sure what number to put next to each of them. So for lack of a clear-cut 2, 3, 4, 5, let's go to Michael Pineda next, who I think the Yankees would love to step into that number two role. Sometimes he looks like he's that guy. Sometimes he doesn't. What's missing? What does he need to figure out?
You know, it's funny. If you do a flyby, Brian Cashman was saying this, if you do a flyby and look at just strikeouts per nine innings, some of those peripheral numbers, I mean, Pineda should be among the best pitchers in the game, but the number of home runs allowed, the damage with two strikes, two outs that has been done against him, it's almost like he seems to lose focus or command at times. You know, and Larry Rothschild, the pitching coach, has kind of scratched his head about that, and Joe Girardi has as well. It's something that they're digging into. They would love to see Pineda come back and fulfill that promise, because when he is on, he looks great. He really does. You know, I remember a couple of years ago that Mother's Day game where he seemed to strike out the world against Baltimore. So, you know, it's almost like you're just waiting for Pineda to put it all together. Obviously, Seattle had high hopes for him. It hasn't worked out with the Yankees as well as they would have imagined thus far. But like Tanaka, this is a potential free agent year for Pineda. So it serves him well if he can put it all together for them.
CeCe Sabathia, obviously so many questions a year ago about him at this time, but he came back and he put together a pretty good season. Wasn't healthy all year long, but in general stayed fairly healthy. And I think we kind of got to see the new CeCe Sabathia, or the older CeCe Sabathia that can still be effective. But it seems like with what he did a year ago, he should be able to do that again, because he's no longer relying on the velocity.
Right, and this has kind of been a transition in the last few years. But some of those advanced metrics, if you take a look at, his soft contact percentage was off the charts. His hard hit percentage, guys were not hitting the ball hard against him. Basically just generating a lot of soft contact. And that's how he really turned out to have probably his best year since 2012. And if you roll the clock back to 2012, that was the year when the Yankees made the playoffs. Sabathia, a much different pitcher at that time. He is in the latter stages of his career, looking to finish on a strong note. But I think that anybody who saw him pitch last year would say he can definitely repeat that, because it's upstairs for him now. He's not just relying on pure velocity to blow past guys. I think that he's proven mentally he's made the adjustments he needs to do. And as long as he hits his spots and his stuff is good, he's going to have success. So I think, look, the Yankees have no illusions. They're not counting on him to be the ace anymore. But if he can be a solid number three for them, they'll be very happy with that.
So you have Tanaka, Pineda, Sabathia, Brian, and then I feel like you almost have to draw a line there before you move on to the other pitchers that could factor into this rotation. Let's talk about Luis Severino next. Obviously, 2015, he burst onto the scene as a top prospect, and he was great down the stretch. And then last year was a completely different story. Ended up, I think, at the end of the day, being his confidence blown and a whole lot of things, but he's slimmer now, and it seems like maybe better prepared to be that guy from 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was something the Yankees brought up to him. They wanted him to – they thought he might have been a little too bulked up going into spring training last year. And if you remember, that was a spring where the Yankees had basically guaranteed him a rotation spot. I mean, that was not a question that he was going to be their number four starter beginning of the year. The results were not there. He was 0-8 as a starter. I believe they lost his first nine starts of last year or so. Nothing was going right for Severino until he came back out of the bullpen. And as dominant as he was out of the bullpen, he had a sub-1 ERA. His future, he believes, is a starter. So he really needs to come back and prove something. He would not be the first starter to hit a couple bumps in the road, but I think there was no accident in how good he looked at the end of 2015. If he can kind of recapture that a little bit, that would be big for the Yankees and big for Severino, because look, he could fall back in the bullpen. That could wind up being his future. But Brian Cashman says, Joe Girardi says, they still see him as a starter. Severino wants to succeed as a starter. It's all he's ever really done. So This is going to be his chance. I think that there's two spots at the end of that rotation, and if Severino can grab one, the Yankees be very happy with that.
Yeah, so you hope Severino gets one of those last two spots in the rotation. And then there's that fifth starter role and a whole bunch of names you can throw into the mix. Adam Warren, 58 games a year ago, only one start. Luis Sessa looked good at times in nine starts last year. There's Chad Green, Brian Mitchell. Brian, just handicap that fifth starter spot for us.
Yeah, and I would throw Chance Adams in there too, who developed into one of the better pitching prospects in the system, and he might break camp in the bullpen. But just breaking down the guys that you did mention there, Sessa looked good at times, as you said. He was hit by the long ball a lot, gave up a few too many home runs. So I think that he has to work on that this spring. Chad Green, his stuff was terrific. He struck out a lot of guys. His strikeouts for nine innings were good. Sabathia was raving about him a couple weeks ago and just said, that guy is nasty. That guy's going to be good at the big league level. So Brian Mitchell was probably their best starting pitcher in camp until in his last outing he hurt his toe, and that pretty much cost him the whole year. He came back and was able to get his first major league win in September, but a pretty incomplete year for Mitchell, who does have big league stuff. So I think that's a guy you want to look at. And I think Warren obviously wants to be a starter. He's done it at the big league level, but his candidacy is hurt a little bit by the fact that he's so good in the bullpen. They know he can just plug in there in the sixth inning and give them quality out. So I think that Warren's preference would be to be the fifth starter, but he'll probably collapse back into that bullpen spot. And if I had to pick one guy who's going to get the job, I'll go with Chad Green just based on stuff alone. I think if he can put together a nice spring, and he did last year, he opened some eyes, did it at the big league level. If he can do that again, I think he might be the guy. If not, Brian Mitchell would be my pick.
All right, there you have it, the handicapping of that fifth spot. And this whole rotation will be interesting to follow throughout spring training. There's a lot of names there. There's certainly plenty of depth. The question for the Yankees will be, is it good enough? You think it is at the top. We'll see how it is 1-5 as the season goes on. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Yankees edition. For Brian Hoke, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. MLB.com Extras here. Our Rays podcast, Tim McMaster, along with our MLB.com Rays reporter, Bill Chastain. And, Bill, time to talk about this Rays starting rotation. And we'll go six deep as far as this podcast goes. And I'm sure spring training will go a long way in deciding who is the actual five guys in this rotation once things get started. But one thing we know is it's a pretty good rotation, and really it stacks up nicely as far as depth goes. There are some question marks that need to be answered if this team's going to be really successful. And I guess we'll start with what may be the biggest question mark, and that is the guy that this team, I guess, hopes will be the ace, and that is Chris Archer. But he's coming off a year, Bill, in which he lost 19 games. Now, the other numbers aren't as bad as that. You know, he did win nine games as well, the ERA around four, and he made 33 starts, and he threw 200 innings, and he struck out 233 guys. So, Bill, when you look at all those numbers as a whole, it feels like the 19 losses weren't really all that fair.
Well, you kind of scratch your head what's going on there because, you know, he's obviously got electric stuff. He's a battler out there. You know, otherwise you wouldn't see 200-plus innings. And, you know, so sometimes you just, you know, have a bad spell here or there where you get tagged with the decision. And, you know, last year just wasn't his year. But, you know, you keep waiting for that real breakout season by him where it's just lights out the whole year. And if that happens, the Rays would be in a really good place.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people thought that might be last year. We mentioned that maybe the 19 losses weren't fair, but there was also times when he really didn't pitch that well. So when Chris Archer wasn't right in 2016, in your mind, Bill, what was going wrong with him?
I think it's just, you know, control issues. And, you know, a lot of guys who throw as hard as he does, you know, it is about control and, you know, repeating the delivery and whatnot. So, you know, he seems to have a good acumen for pitching. And, you know, and again, like I said, you know, he's plenty tough. If you're going out there for 200-plus innings, you know, that's kind of the blue-collar badge for a pitcher. So, you know, again, if this thing comes together, it could be really, really important for the team.
Yeah, and they kind of need that. I feel like they need him to be one of those guys, especially with a couple of guys that are obviously gone from last year as well. Matt Moore traded late in the year. Drew Smyly traded during this offseason. So Archer, you hope, is the number one, I think. And then after that, I'm not sure if it's easy to kind of number the guys or they just will take their turns. But let's go with Jake Odorizzi next, because when you look at innings pitched last year, he checks in next. 187 2/3 innings, for Jake in 2016. He also made 33 starts. The number's a little bit better than Archer. Does he have the stuff to really be what people would consider a number two starter?
I think so. And, I mean, he was as good as any pitcher in the American League in the second half last year. He really knows what he's doing out there. You know, he doesn't dazzle a lot of people, but, you know, he executes his pitches. You know, he's got three good pitches. So, you know, I just think he's one of those guys, you know, you just hang him out there and, you know, you can expect 15 wins. He's really come a long way. He's gotten stronger. I just like the way he's going.
And then after that, let's talk Alex Cobb, because Alex Cobb obviously returned late last year from the Tommy John surgery. Before that surgery, he looked like he was on his way to being a top-notch pitcher in the American League. We saw flashes of really good stuff when he returned. Overall, the numbers were poor, but you kind of expect that when a guy first comes back. He ended up going 1-2. He made 5 starts after coming back, the ERA in the 8s, but he did show, like I said, a few flashes there. And they always say, Bill, that even though guys come back in 12 to 18 months, sometimes it's another, you know, 6 months or another half season before they're really themselves again. So how important was it that he was able to come back and make those 5 starts for this year?
Oh, I think that's the most important thing. I think that erases a lot of doubt, and it kind of gets him in a mode where he could go into the off season like it's a regular off season instead of rehabbing. You know, obviously, you come back from being away that long and your control is just not going to be quite as good. I mean, you know, these guys are so good putting the ball where they want to put it. And, you know, you've been doing it for a long time and you get more and more accustomed to being able to put it where you want it. And you kind of lose a little bit of feel for that, I think, when you're away. But he did get enough work in, and I think he was able to kind of get a feel for competing again. So I think he felt good leaving the season the way he did.
How much will the team monitor his innings this year, and will they skip him at time? I mean, is there a plan to kind of keep those innings down in 2017?
You know, I haven't heard anything about that. Of course, I'm sure that's a possibility, but I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, and then there's different ways for teams to do that these days, especially when you have an abundance of starting pitchers where the Rays can work some other guys in. All right, Blake Snell got his real first long look last year in the major leagues, threw 89 innings. The strikeouts were good, 98 strikeouts in that time. He went 6-8. All the records on this pitching staff from a year ago seem to be slightly deceiving, Bill, when you look around the horn. But what were your impressions of Blake Snell in 2016? 2015 was the year that he kind of burst on the scene in the minor leagues. He had that long stretch of scoreless innings. How was he at the major league level last year?
Well, first off, I really liked the way he didn't seem to be rattled about anything. You know, I know that there's probably a lot he's got to tighten up, in his, delivery probably and repeating his pitches and whatnot. But he doesn't seem to get rattled, and I think that's a mark of a good pitcher. So I would not be surprised if he made really big strides this year after having the taste of it last year and, an off season to kind of absorb what he learned. So, but he's got the tools, and, I think he could, have a nice season for him.
Is it fair to say that those 4 guys, Archer, Odorizzi, Snell, and Cobb, are kind of locks to be in this rotation?
I would think so.
And then you have kind of the other 2 guys, Matt Andrews. You have Jose De Leon, obviously, who the team just traded for. I know they haven't come out and said anything yet. It feels like Jose De Leon has done enough in the minor leagues that he's ready to be a major league pitcher or at least get that real look. Is that going to be a competition you expect for that 5th spot in spring training? May the best man survive?
Yeah, and I'd throw Chase Whitley in there,
and
too.
Whitley, yeah.
The bottom line is the first thing is you start with the health of your rotation, and it's really pretty rare I know the Rays fans got used to it they had a pretty good run for several years there where nobody was getting injured or dinged up. But I think it's usually pretty unusual for a staff to leave spring training without 1 or 2 guys maybe get dinged up. So a lot of times these decisions get made for you by the health of your rotation. After that, you'd probably see if Andrees or Whitley aren't the guy, you might see them fold into the bullpen. I'd probably be surprised if De Leon is actually on that rotation, but I haven't seen him pitch yet either. So But based on the way they kind of do things, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he started in the minors and had an early call-up.
Makes a lot of sense, too, to getting comfortable in a new organization as well. That's a good point. And the good thing about Andrees and Whitley, as you said, they're both guys, Bill, who have been effective in the bullpen. It's not just throwing them out there and seeing how it goes. Both these guys can be bullpen arms, which certainly helps as far as just being able to move these guys to kind of different places and have that ability to be creative.
Right, and both are great teammates, too. So, you know, that's a pretty good group of guys they got going for their starting rotation.
On paper, it looks like a really good staff. It looked like a really good staff a year ago, and not everything necessarily came together. But if it does, you would think that this Rays team is in good shape on the mound, and they've, of course, made some additions in the field as well. We will see how it all plays out soon enough. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rays edition. For Bill Chastain, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here and pinch hitting for Ian Brown this week on the podcast. It's Jim Duquette. And Duke, thanks a lot for joining us. Ian taking a break, getting his rest in before spring training. So thanks for picking up the slack.
Always good to pick up for Ian. And he has the deserved time off before things get a little hectic down there in Fort Myers for the Red Sox and him.
Yeah, he'll be heading down to JetBlue Park before we know it. All right, so we've been going around the roster, basically, position by position, and you step in for the starting rotation, which is an exciting spot to talk about as far as this Red Sox team goes. And it's a team that it's kind of a three-headed monster there at the top of the rotation. We might as well start with the new guy, Chris Sale. Obviously, the big trade in the offseason. The Red Sox gave up a lot to get him. They bring in Chris Sale. Now, a year ago, we saw David Price struggle a little bit, at least early on and then off and on throughout the season. There's a lot to get used to when you join the Red Sox. How do you expect Chris Sale to adapt?
You know, I think with Sale, it's interesting because, you know, he's pitched in a big market in Chicago. There's no doubt. The competitiveness, you know, is there. And that's the same thing with David Price. I think there's always a little bit of getting used to. I think that wall over your left, over, I guess, his right shoulder when he's standing on the mound is a lot closer than you think. But I think overall, there's a little bit of pressure there, but there's also, I think, the feeling that you've got the Cy Young, reigning Cy Young Award winner in Porcello there on your staff, and David Price, the big money guy. Like he should, I think it's with Sale, it's a matter of, hey, I just need to fit in here. It takes a little bit of pressure off, I would think. And I actually think it creates a little internal competition with that top three. So I think that he's going to get off to a really good start. I think the fact that his stuff is so dominant, he still has that strikeout pitch, that breaking ball. That's what I think is maybe a little bit more different, let's say a little different than David Price had. You know, Price's stuff, you know, it's I wouldn't say taking a big step back, but it has taken a little bit of a step back. He's not quite the strikeout guy before, but Sale certainly still is.
Sale's never pitched in the postseason, and obviously everyone in New England expects him to in 2017, but he's just got to be on a high right now, and he's got to be arriving at spring training with just an extra amount of energy, knowing that, hey, for the first time in a while, I can realistically think that this team's going to contend.
Yeah, I think, you know, and he even said that. He was amazed when he showed up for the Red Sox Fan Fest and how welcoming the fan base was. And that's always temporary, you know, a couple struggles out of the gate, and then we know that fan base can change. But it's hard-pressed to find a more supportive group. And really, I mean, if you look at this team in particular, he was really that final piece that you feel like gets them, you know, over the top. It's a team that, you know, already got to that postseason, won the tough American League East the year before. So I think from that side of it, the transition should be good. And you know, as you mentioned, you know, when you're joining a team that's expected to win, there are certain expectations, certain pressures there. But I think it's shared with a lot of that group that's already been there.
Yeah, and of course, the other two guys, you mentioned Porcello and Price, they've actually won Cy Young Awards. Chris Sale hasn't, although it seems like every single year he's in the discussion. Porcello, the reigning AL Cy Young winner, 22-4 last year, but people that are on the kill the win bandwagon would say he got an awful lot of run support. So when you look at Porcello and what he did a year ago, can we assume that there might be a little bit of regression in 2017?
Yeah, I think it's fair, Tim. I really do that. You know, maybe there is a little bit of regression. It was hard to pitch at that level But I feel also that Porcello, you know, he's gotten better, you know, each year. And as long as he doesn't try to come in and top what he did this past year, which is, again, it's hard to top. As long as he doesn't try that, I think he'll be fine. I think he's always been a guy that, you know, has gotten the ground ball. But what he did last year was he realized that there was outs up in the strike zone, and that plays from year to year when you're not as predictable. So with the success that he had last year, I think he also learned and grew as a pitcher, and I expect him to be able to take that and really incorporate it into his game again this year.
David Price won 17 games in 2016, but I think the number that stands out more maybe for Red Sox fans is that he lost 9 games in the regular season. On this podcast a year ago, I remember talking to Ian Brown and him saying he thought David Price would get off to a slow start and struggle early on simply because of the contract, because of the adjustments to Boston and what guys have to go through. But he said then that he thought Price over the length of, you know, year two, year three, year four of this deal would be great. Do you agree with that? Do you think David Price, we'll see a different David Price in 2017 than we did last year?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, again, that some of the pressure of the big contract, you've seen plenty of guys, you know, come in and feel that and take that on. If you look at, you know, what he did over the first half, it was a real struggle overall. His numbers in April, May, June, there wasn't one month where his ERA was under 4. And, you know, in April it was over almost 6. So, you know, as he got to July and August, you started to see a better David Price. You saw, you know, in September a little bit of a step back, but he did win 4 games. So I feel like the last kind of two out of the last 3 months, he was able to build momentum, get back to what made him successful. And I think those are things that he'll build on for this year.
All right, so there's your big three, and a lot is obviously expected of those guys as far as innings, as far as wins, and just leading this team. The last two spots open on the rotation are just that. I think they're open heading into spring training. We can kind of handicap the favorites, but you have Steven Wright, who was an all-star in 2016, and really, when David Price was struggling early in the season, kind of carried the way for this Red Sox team along with Porcello, led the American League with 4 complete games. You have Drew Pomeranz, who is also an all-star, although in the National League with the Padres, and he struggled a bit with the Red Sox once he came over at the trade deadline. And then you have Eduardo Rodriguez, who after a tremendous 2015 at just 22 years old, had the knee injury in spring training a year ago and kind of struggled through 2016. So those are your three guys. Duke, is there a favorite in that group to be, I guess, the fourth starter, we'll call it? I mean, two of these guys are going to be in the rotation.
Two are going to be in the rotation. I think part of this is also, I talked to John Farrell today, he said, you know, past experience out of the bullpen is going to also be a factor in this. And so you look at it, you know, Pomeranz has pitched out of the pen, right, has a little bit. Eduardo Rodriguez hasn't much, but he also has options. His stuff, by the way, Rodriguez's stuff, on any given night might be as good as anybody's on the staff. You know, it's funny how this is going to play out. You know, do you want to go with 4 left-handed pitchers in your rotation and have Steven Wright coming out of the pen? You know, sometimes the balance of your starting rotation plays into this decision as well. So I don't know if there's any real front runners. You know, it's hard to say the All-Stars that were there last year wouldn't make it. But then, you know, again, Rodriguez has got the big arm. So he played it pretty coy. I think the Red Sox, you know, have an idea of, you know, who that next guy would be. I wouldn't be surprised if Steven Wright was the leader for the 4th spot. And then the number 5 spot, you know, he's kind of up in the air between Pomeranz and Rodriguez.
You mentioned the bullpen factor. And, I mean, you with Wright, you don't always want a knuckleballer coming out of the bullpen either.
Right.
I mean, we saw that with, although, to mix
Wakefield's done it before, right?
Yeah.
It's not ideal, that is for sure. But, it, you know, it's also one of those where, you know, they can also eat up innings if you need it and help save your bullpen too. So that's why I also feel kind of along the lines where maybe you were headed, which was right, you know, in the rotation as well. Again, to have that another right-hander, and he's different. That kind of makeup of the staff, when you have a knuckleballer, it really gives you an advantage. It changes the look of your starting rotation. So, again, Wright sounded like he was doing well health-wise. I wouldn't be surprised if he has the inside track.
Yeah, and a lot of the negatives as far as Pomerantz goes a year ago was innings because, yes, he struggled with the Red Sox, but when he came over in the trade, I believe he had already pitched more innings than he ever had in his career up to that point. And then he obviously went way over that the rest of the season. On the other hand of that, other side of that argument is that he went from Petco Park in the National League West to Fenway Park in the American League East, and there's obviously a change there as well. So spring training, I think, really big for Drew Pomerantz. You mentioned you talked to John Farrell, and he probably had some thoughts on this as well, Duke. But when you think about Red Sox spring training 2017 as opposed to 2016, there's going to be differences. Obviously, there's new faces, but I think is the biggest difference not having David Ortiz there?
I think that's the biggest difference. I really do. And John basically talked about that. The loss of him in the lineup is something that is a concern, and they have talked about it on how they would handle it. It's not quite the same without him there, the presence in the middle of his lineup. Now, what they're hoping is if they got below league average production at both third base and left field, they're hoping that Pablo Sandoval can come back and play to his abilities. That's number one. They have a protection there with Brock Holt, but they're hopeful, and he's in terrific shape. And they're hoping that a full season of Andrew Benintendi will be an upgrade over what they had in left field, which is not unrealistic to think about as well. So I think if they got production like that, league average or so, from those two positions, that could make up for a portion, maybe more than that, of what Ortiz with his absence. Still going to be interesting for me to see how that middle of the lineup is shaped. When you have, obviously, Bogarts and Betts and, Pedroia, let's say all of those guys near the top, Hanley somewhere in the middle. Who ends up sorting those parts out? Does Leon have the same type of season as he did, although he started to get exposed towards the end of last year? So they still have a lot of decisions to make in the middle of that lineup. Still a very good team, though.
Yeah, certainly. And if you get the better pitching, maybe you don't need quite the because the offense a year ago was so good.
Yeah.
It could probably take a little step back if you get the better pitching, and you're still going to be a team that should be a contender for not just the division, but people are thinking a World Series contender for sure in 2017. All right. Thank you so much, Jim Duquette, for stepping in for Ian Brown this week. That'll do it for MLB.com Extras, our Red Sox edition. Tune in again next time.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.